still flat, and clouds made of fire, and mountains stretched up to the sky, sometimes higher.
And welcome to the Boys You Love podcast, the podcast where I get to sit down and talk to all sorts of interesting people from all over the world about movies they love. And this week we're going to be going all the way to New York City with Door Dots. Usually I tend to bring on bloggers and all sorts of writers and podcasters, but she doesn't really do all of those things. She is just, as she quotes herself, a movie lover. She is a big festival junkie. You'll hear her talk about it in this conversation, and just great lover of film. This week we kind of sit down and talk about Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which is like this insane movie. I don't want to make it sound too crazy, because it's actually really good, and you guys should go and check it out if you haven't heard of it or seen it before. But anyways, I'm gonna let it just go straight into the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, whether you like it or not.
Ow!
Hedwig! Don't you know me, Kansas City? I'm the new Berlin Wall. Try and tear me down.
How did some slip of a girly boy become the internationally ignored song stylist barely standing before you?
Damn, handsome. I can't believe you're not a girl.
Looks like we got some sugar daddies in the house. You could give me a cavity, honey.
Now you're interested, huh?
Inch, yeah. Not itch.
Intrigued. It is clear that I must find my other half. But is it a he or a she? Can two people actually become one?
So, Door, you've asked us to talk about the 2001 feature film Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And I'm kind of curious, before we get into anything that is the narrative of this movie, can you tell me, what was the first time you actually saw this film?
Actually, I saw it in early 2001 on the last day of the Sundance Film Festival.
Of the Sundance Film Festival?
Yeah, it was this thing where, I think my second or my third year going to Sundance. I can't really do math, but I was very early in my Sundance attendance, and I was choosing all my movies as, I think, embarrassingly enough, I did very often as a 22-year-old. I was choosing a lot of my movies based on, you know, kind of who was starring in them. And so this movie, Hedwig, wasn't on my radar at all. In fact, when I read about it, it just didn't look that good to me. And throughout the week, as kind of happens at film festivals, I started hearing more and more about it. People would say, people behind me in line would be talking to one another about how, oh, it's just the must-see film of the festival. And they started talking about, you know, awards buzz for it and this and that. And I was like, yeah, I still don't want to see it. I missed the second screening of it. I think they even had a third screening of it, and I missed that too. And thank goodness it actually did win awards at Sundance, and that prompted it to show on the last day. And what ended up happening was there was like one time slot on the last day of the festival that I couldn't see any other film. I had seen all the others that had won and were playing in that time slot. And I was like, okay, the universe wants to force me to see Hedwig and the Angry Inch, I guess. And I went in, and I think it was maybe about 40 minutes into the movie that I was like, yeah, this is my favorite movie of all time. We're done with this. Yeah. I'm the idiot here. That's the answer to your question. I saw it.
You mentioned, it's there on your Twitter, you are a movie person. You say 2001 was your third year going to Sundance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have been going to Sundance and attending film festivals since then, 1999. So that's been 15 mm-hmm. years?
Yeah, this year's Sundance will be my 15th.
So, my question, what inspired this this festival fever that you can't seem to shake?
Well, honestly, I started really loving movies not until I was about 17 or 18, and when I moved out of my parents' house. My mom was obsessed with movies, with old movies. And as you kind of do when you're a kid, you just kind of are repelled from whatever your parents are into. So I was never a big movie person when I was a kid, though we did go pretty often. It wasn't a passion of mine by any stretch. But then when I moved out, I actually moved from Minnesota to Los Angeles, and I had a friend there who's big on independent film. So we would rent a different independent film every night. And we started kind of, I think she had some industry aspirations at the time. So she would introduce me to all these indie films that I hadn't heard before. And it was, right when that was starting to get really big. And so there was one year that I had read about a movie in production that I really wanted to see. And I didn't know when I was going to see it or where I was going to see it, but I really liked the star in it. And I really loved the premise. And I had heard, I guess on the internet or something, that it was going to play Sundance that year. It was like December of that year. And I had read that, this movie had been picked up, had been selected to play Sundance. And I was like, wow, I wonder how you get to go to that. And I looked up and I was like, anybody can go if they, pay the money for the movie ticket and get themselves there. And I looked up and it was a, pretty cheap flight. So I said, I'm going to do it. The movie was incidentally, But I'm a Cheerleader. It's still a cute and quirky little comedy. But anyways, it's what got me to want to go to Sundance. And I only stayed, 3 days that first trip. And I was always kind of a brave kid. Like I did this thing where I booked a flight for, and then I was like, all the hotels are sold out. That's fine. I'll just figure it out when I get there. And I don't know if I've ever been to Sundance, but lodging is not something that one figures out when one gets there. So I didn't figure it out when I got there. I totally couldn't find a place to stay. And I ended up just chilling in the lobby of one of the hotels, and hanging out on my computer all night long and kind of dozing off here or there. It was, needless to say, I loved the experience. Sundance, it was only 3 days for me, but I absolutely loved it from start to finish. I saw a girl fight that year. I saw a couple of really just great films, even though I was only there for a few days. And the day I got home is the day I started saving to go the next year for 10 days and actually, get a hotel and all that good stuff. And I just never stopped going. And I've gone to Sundance, 14 years. And TIFF is a festival that I added, the Toronto Film Festival. I added that to my slate maybe, 7 or 8 years ago.
So how many festivals is it that you tend to visit a year?
Well, the problem is that once I add them, it's so hard to not go again. I end up liking them so much that I have to go every year, and that's starting to get a little bit unmanageable. I think last year I went to 9, which I feel like was a little bit too many, but it was awesome. It's just kind of addictive. I have one of those personalities that's like, you have that fear of missing out. So I think oh God, if I don't go, there's going to be all this good stuff that everybody else is going to get to see and I won't get to see it. And then I'll be behind. I better be there. So yeah, last year I went to Sundance, Tribeca, South by, Seattle, randomly, Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, Hot Docs, Fantastic Fest, Toronto, I can't remember the others. Yeah, and this year I'll go to almost all those. I didn't go back to Seattle.
Do you see yourself adding any in this year or the following?
I really wanted to. The problem is that my job gives me 20 vacation days, which is pretty generous for an American company, but is still not really enough for me. So I'm lucky that my company has an office and I have some reports in Toronto, so I can work a few days from there during the festival and, preserve my vacation time. Same goes for a few of the other cities, they'll be flexible with in that regard. If I could add any, I would love to go to Telluride and Cannes. I've never been to either one of those, and I would very much like to.
So, pulling it back to the film itself of Hedwig the Angry Inch for the moment, can you tell me a little bit more about how you ended up appreciating this film upon the first viewing at that time?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kind of drew you in? You said it was around the 45-minute mark that you decided this was your favorite film of all time.
What initially got me to just love it is the music. And so it's a musical, right? Some people would call it a rock opera. I'm not sure that I would call it that, though, because there certainly is a strong narrative and a dialogue, and there are just musical numbers. But it's kind of, people have compared it to Tommy or to, often it gets compared to Rocky Horror, in that it has this kind of a cult appreciation, if you will. But what immediately stood out to me was how, I guess, the showmanship of it. There's a lot of musical numbers. They're all great, and they're all great in their own ways. You know, there'll be these, beautiful ballads, and rock stuff, you name it. And they're all a bit stylized. Like there's one scene where the character is singing, and it's a song that's very much like very emotional, very very deeply felt, about where the musical number itself is almost like the character escaping into her own mind, right? Where she's, it's like this dissociation of some kind, and imagine this fabulous life. There's a sadness to it, but it's also this really upbeat and fun, catchy poppy song where there's actually like a sing-along item to it, where they're actually putting the words on the screen in a little, bouncing ball so the audience can sing along type of a thing. That's the type of stylization that comes up in some of the musical numbers, and it's fun and it's cute, but it's not only fun and cute. It's also very, there's a strong emotional element to it, I guess. So that's what first resonated with me, was the music.
Right. And it's something that I found very interesting rewatching this movie last night, because it's a film I've seen before. It's a film that I was introduced to by my older brother, Douglas, who, he's coming to TIFF this year, so you'll get to meet him.
Cool. If he's a Hedwig fan, I'm sure we'll get along.
Yeah, he's crazy for this movie. And I fell in love with it the first time, and it's weird enough that after each rewatch, I kind of start to see a few cracks here and there.
Yeah.
But something that I found really weird was that if you watch this movie up until the 45-minute mark, you can kind of gauge that musical/rock opera feel.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of begins a whole different movie where it becomes, because for that first 45 minutes, I really would love to ask someone to point out to me where they're not singing, where they're not mm-hmm. expressing every kind of emotional or narrative beat through song. After that 45-minute mark, leading to a lot of the Tommy Gnosis things,
mm-hmm.
it stops that and becomes very much a traditional film for the most part.
I don't disagree. I think there's a lot of dialogue in the first half. I think maybe the most memorable parts in the first half are the scenes, and I mean the musical scenes, and that they kind of pack the most punch, where the dialogue in the first half is more exposition. But there is a lot of dialogue, I feel like.
Well, there are lots of interstitial moments, because for mm-hmm. the most part, unlike anything that you would call a traditional musical, even the parts where there is a lot of music, they're not really doing what musicals usually do, which is create this grand distracting moment of song and dance. It's kind mm-hmm. of because it's all really performances, so you're generally there in the performance, while mm-hmm. it will jump away to like an animation every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
You're just at the performance. During that time, you'll have a pause in a song, and they'll be like, well, this song is really a story about when I was a child and
mm-hmm.
I had this operation. But I kind of count that all as part of the song, because I kind of think of it as, if I was actually listening to this, if this was a Who album where mm-hmm. I was listening to this, they probably would have done that as a part of the track. It's not just something that you would have seen at the concerts.
Yeah, I don't know. I can do that. Sure.
And that's kind of how I take the music, the whole operatic moment of it. And you kind of seemed a little dismissive of people calling this a rock opera.
No, I mean, I don't think that's a pejorative in any way. I think there are a lot of people who might think they wouldn't like musicals. I'm sorry, they don't like musicals, or we would associate that with something bad that would still like Hedwig, but I like rock operas, but.
No, yeah, I'm not using it as a negative. I mean, I think the biggest attribute which kind of makes it comparative to rock operas is the fact that a lot of the musical moments in this movie, they're all very storytelling kind of music. It's very descriptive.
It's just to move the narrative, yeah.
Yeah, it's never just a completely distracting moment, which is...
That's true. Yeah, for sure.
And that's kind of, I think, the biggest thing about this film in itself is the music that you can kind of go, oh, so this is the story of when you met your GI husband. And I'm trying to remember his name right now. And for some reason, my brain is saying Luther, but I'm not sure.
Yeah,
okay.
That's it.
Okay. And it kind of takes you on this lyrical journey, which makes it that much more enthralling that you can follow the music as opposed to just having it as a melody to just keep your eyes going with a visual moment. But to come back to you, this is a movie which maybe if it's not so much that the top half is packed with music and the bottom half is slightly a bit more sparse, in that sense, it feels very divided. And even for a film which talks about sexuality as a division, which talks about the Cold War to deal with the Berlin Wall dividing worlds, did you see any sense of division that this film kind of rang true with you when you were watching it?
That's a great question. Well, I am a Gemini, and there's some kind of association with duality. I'm definitely, especially back then, strongly identified as bisexual. So I can see how, I don't watch it and immediately associate myself with it or sort of project, this character is going through this, so I was going through that. You know, I wouldn't say that I strongly identify with it in that way, but I certainly think that the depth of the character is compelling enough that maybe it does hit something in me that it might not as strongly in other people. But I think maybe it's more that as I watched it as a young person and I see the film a lot as making a comment on identity and trying to reconcile two different sides of yourself and growing and accepting and that kind of thing.
So I'm assuming this being like one of your favorite movies of all time, that it's a film which you revisit relatively often, or at least more often than others.
I've probably seen it about 20 times, maybe a little bit more. It's definitely one of those, like, if I meet somebody new, they've got to watch this before they can get to know me too much.
So my question is, like, other than the moment of awe that you had at Sundance in 01, how is it that this film has transformed for you over the years?
You mean, like, how has my opinion towards it transformed? You know, honestly, like, when I think back to what my favorite movies were in 2001, or my other favorite movies I loved that year, around that year, some of them hold up, some of them really don't when I revisit them. I would say this is a movie that, for me, even as I become a more informed movie watcher, I still find no fault in this film, and I don't have any nostalgic associations with it. That makes any sense. I can still enjoy it. I still find ways to enjoy it as whoever I am in the moment. And I feel like I'll get something out of it 10 and 20 years from now as well. It's not one of those, like, you know, that you kind of look back and go like, oh, I remember when I loved these types of things. Like, it's still very much relevant and interesting for me. Maybe it's kind of like a, I'm not sure that it's, I wish that I could say that it had changed that much, but I think, you know, I get a deeper understanding of it. And every, you know, the more that I watch it, the more I start thinking about, well, what did the filmmaker mean what was the meaning of the ending? And, you know, how, what was that trying to signify? Where I think the first few times I watched it, I was probably a lot more focused on the songs and the narrative, you know, the story, just for what it was. Less kind of thinking more deeply on the choices that the filmmaker made. But I think for me, I always do a kind of expect to find, like, even in some of my favorite movies, I'll go back and watch them and be like, oh yeah, this. But this one doesn't really happen. I'm not to the point where I notice stuff, you know, like, you know how when you watch a movie for the first 10 times, I want to say you're picking up one or two more things that you didn't even necessarily notice. I wouldn't say, I think that period of enjoying this film is over for me, but I do think a lot more about the greater meaning of it.
I'm wondering, since you mentioned the ending, and it's something that I kind of took note of too as well, revisiting this movie, because it almost feels like if you kind of take the origin of love song that comes early in the film, where he talks about people being split into two and having to come together to kind of realize how they used to be, and even how you see the display of the tattoo change from earlier in the film to at that end, is it talking about, do you see this as the fact that Tommy Gnosis was actually just another version of who Hedwig was?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And that all of this film is him coming to terms with everything that's going on to bring himself back together?
Absolutely, because there's this element for the character where he, you know, for the first half of the movie, he's kind of a little bit forced to be someone that he's not, in order to be where he wants to be. And I think one thing that's really telling is, and I can't vouch for this myself because I've never seen the live show, but I was told that the original the original off-Broadway show, Tommy and Hedwig were actually played by the same actor. I can't imagine how that would go down, but I look forward to doing that when it does play Broadway next year. But I think absolutely, and that's exactly what the ending is to me. An element of reconciliation and acceptance, where the character kind of realizes, you know, things aren't necessarily black or white. There are shades of gray. That's okay. There's that element of, can things exist in the shadows, or do they have to be these clear cut labels? And the character of this very long journey to get there, but ultimately he realizes that more than external validation, or some need to be someone he's not and someone kind of pigeonholed as man or woman necessarily, he can exist as an individual, even if that's sort of caught in the middle, if you will.
So then what is trying to happen in this film when, at that point in time, when he becomes Tommy Gnosis again, or for the first time, that his bandmate, who I don't remember if actually got a character name, becomes Hedwig, where he just bestows that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's almost a parallel, isn't it? Because the entire movie, that character, Yitzhak, is forced to be someone that he's not. You know, he's kind of repressing his own identity, if you will, because it's what's expected of him and what his bandmates want and what Hedwig needs, right? And so there's a parallel acceptance by that character, Which is also a powerful admission on Hedvig's part that it's okay not to be, to take the lead, not to be the star, not to be the. So I think that's an element of character development for Hedvig, and also it's absolutely a parallel narrative for that other, for that secondary character, Itzhak. And it's a beautiful moment, if nothing else. It just feels so like rewarding, and it's very satisfying to watch that happen because it's such a surprise for that character at the time. So I find it very beautiful.
It's weird that when I see films like this where we're dealing with main characters who are telling us a story, but you realize at some point that they are telling us such an internal story that they're able to warp reality into their own version of it, that I try to consolidate what the actual reality is versus what we actually are able to see. So with all of this Tominosis creation that we're seeing towards the end of the film, I'm trying to reevaluate all of the earlier moments where Tominosis is playing next door or he's doing a signing at a mall, and I'm trying to figure out like where did his perception end and the rest of the world begin in this world. Is this something that bothers you with films like this, or am I just the only crazy one here?
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, did you see Holy Motors after you watched that? Did you need an explanation? Were you very focused on finding a narrative? Not that I would compare the two films very much, but I think that there is a certain moviegoer that absolutely does want to understand every piece of the story. I wouldn't call myself that person. Is there a right answer? Maybe, but I haven't given it much thought. And I'm not sure if in this case the filmmaker necessarily intends it. Same with a film like, I mean, at the extreme, like Holy Motors, where it absolutely is more about a feeling and an overall meaning than any like sensical narrative. A little bit the same goes with an Upstream Color type of a film as well, where if you do go back and try and piece every little thing together, there are going to be things that will always be unclear or may not line up. But for me, I like to just kind of focus on how does it leave me feeling at the end of it and what is the overall meaning? Because I'm not sure. I just am not sure. It is interesting to think about, you know, with that mindset, knowing that that may very well be the intent of the filmmaker to have said it was the same person all along. It can be fun to go back and think, oh, well, what would that mean in this scene? What would that mean in that scene? But I'm just not sure that it's going to be a rewarding experience for you, because there might not be a solution, you know, or you can't solve that mystery. It's fun to think about that.
Yeah, it definitely is. But I'm going to jump back a little bit, and I'm going to go back to what we were talking about with your initial falling in love with films. You were mentioning things like how your mother was a big fan of films. She used to watch a lot of older movies, and you kind of shunned away from that side of cinema for at least a while. I don't know, have you come back to that side and gone back to those movies that, which your mother loved? And
yeah, for sure. For sure I have. She hasn't really moved too far past the 40s and 50s in her own movie watching. Like, don't ask me to tell you about when I showed my parents Hedvig and Angry Inch. But yeah, for sure. Because as my own, like, you know, interest in cinema continued, I would get into these conversations with some of my friends. And you know, you talk about your blind spots, right? Like, the blind spots that I had and still have are pretty embarrassing. I can tell you that I spent Christmas Day this year at the 92Y Tribeca in New York watching Back to the Future Parts 1 and 2 for the first time, for example. So not that I would call that, I mean, it's repertory cinema, but it's probably not what you meant. But yes, absolutely. I'm very lucky that I live in the city that I live, right, in New York, because I have a problem watching things at home. I can't focus very well on anything that's not in the theater. I just get really distracted, and I don't believe in kind of half watching something. So I just don't tend to watch a lot at home, right? I just watch in the theater. But when I commitment to watching more repertory cinema, which I think that was about a year and a half ago that I did take a very vested interest, I was really just surrounded by just, you know, there's New York is saturated by repertory cinema houses. And so I've seen, I think like last year alone, I went to, which isn't that impressive of a number compared to my friends, but I feel like I saw about 40 or 50 screenings of other films. For example, I saw Annie Hall for the first time. I saw a lot of the Cirque melodramas. Film Forum was doing a series that showed a bunch of those. Red, White, and Blue, the French films. That movie Red, that was, I think, the best repertory screening that I saw last year.
Those remain in my blind spot.
Ooh, yeah, I have to recommend it. And it's tough, too, because when you have those blind spots, it's really hard to watch films with an open mind, right, and not have things overhyped. You know, I saw Ghostbusters for the first time last year. You can't evaluate that without any hype. And second of all, as an adult, that's really hard to do. But those films, those three films, absolutely, well, particularly the last one, Red, absolutely live up to the hype. So that was pretty cool.
I'm just thinking about it and I realized something kind of funny. Red is the last film, and I remember someone putting up a joke, like someone has on their shelf the Blue, White, and Red, and they say it's the wrong way around, and it's like, no, it's because it's the France colors, you know. But you said it Red, White, and Blue, so I was like, my brain just kind of ticked with, oh
yeah,
it's kind of weird.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah, that's pretty. Yeah, I guess I sure did. I guess we're just trained to say, I just must be trained to say those colors in an order, as an American. That's kind of embarrassing. But at least I do know the real order of them. And I did watch them in chronological order. Only the last one, Red, was showing in theaters. But of course, I knew it was playing, so I watched the other two in advance. It was just an incredibly rewarding experience, and I can't recommend it more highly.
So, like, with the fact that you have this amount of cinematic amazingness around you all the while, like, how is it that you're able to traverse without getting lost in the world of cinema, or is it that you're always looking to get lost?
Do you mean how do I narrow down what I want to see?
Yeah.
Well, I'm lucky in that I have people that are close to me that will point me in the right direction, of whom will kind of say, yeah, you got to see this, or this is right up your alley, or might say, hey, I'm going to go to this, you should come along, and I'll do that. But ultimately, I tend to go with films that I haven't seen before that are very memorable to me, that stand out, that I've heard a lot about, that I think, well, I better see that, versus some like super obscure thing that, you know, most people would be freaking out about because it's never, you know, it's never played before. I tend to, you know, like I saw for the first time last year about 14 of Hitchcock's films. Before last year I had seen one Hitchcock film, and now I've seen like about 15 of them. So I do a little bit go with the most notorious of what's showing, which might or might not be the right approach. You know, I missed that William Friedkin film that was playing, The Sorcerer, right, that was playing at BAM. It didn't meet my filters there, if you will, although I did certainly want to try and correct that, but it was long sold out and I feel like I was out of town too or something. But I'm also pretty lucky that like a lot of these establishments have membership programs, right? So that helps me narrow it down. Like I have a membership to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, which, believe it or not, shows that has like a really robust repertory film program. I saw they did a James Bond retrospective last year, so I saw my first James Bond films last year. And with those, I knew enough about that, you know, that franchise to know that I didn't necessarily need to see all of them. So I asked some of my, you know, James Bond freak friends which ones are the best ones to see, and I caught, I think I saw In Your Majesty's Secret Service and some other one. It was all about, like, there was a lot of skiing, downhill skiing. I don't remember the title. But, and then there's another theater in New York called the IFC Center, which has this incredible membership program that's where you pay, like, the top tier of it is where you pay, like, $1,000 for the year. And then you just get 2 free tickets to anything you want to see ever, all the time. So I could go see movies all day long for free with a friend, or I could go just catch the things on the weekend or whatever. And I saw a lot. That's how I saw all the Alfred Hitchcock films. And they did, like, a Mel Brooks retrospective. And they've done, like, right now they're doing this series that's all just movies made in Texas and stuff like that. They're maybe my, honestly, I think they're my favorite New York theater, because they're, they've got real strong first run stuff as well as a great rep cinema showing as well.
I wish there was more of you in the Caribbean.
Oh.
Because while we don't have the IFC Center or the theaters, I know it's mainly because there aren't enough of you and me there to make them viable.
Well, what is the film community like there, if anything?
I don't know if it exists yet. Actually, that's mean harsh. Within Jamaica, it's kind of just mainstream and whatever we can get at that point. I must say, coming to Trinidad, and I've been living here for near 2 years, just about 2 years, they actually have like 3 festivals which run throughout the year, not throughout the year, within the year. There's the Trinidad and Tobago Film Festival, which plays a lot of Caribbean films. There's the European Film Festival, which will play a lot of the European films from the year gone by. And even a couple older ones. So you'll see a few 1960s films playing. And there's also a few tiny screenings that go around the year, which I find really interesting. I've been happy to find that there is a cinematic, following out within the Caribbean.
Well, what you should do is you should start a film festival out there that, like, aims to market to filmmakers and position it as, like, a vacation spot. There's, like, that Aruba Film Festival that has succeeded in that on a small scale. Maybe you can position it in that way.
It's a plan. You're going to come and help me? Come on, let's go do it. I just want to ask one more thing, kind of thinking about Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I remember you telling me that in 2001 at Sundance, it wasn't a film that was on your radar, and it was only after hearing so many people talk about it to it then winning the award, finally being shown on the final night, you said, let me give this a shot, and you did. I'm kind of curious, did this experience of Hedwig and the Angry Inch change what you used as your stick for what you need to be seeing?
For sure. Without a doubt. I would say that it wasn't like, you know, a flipping a light switch. I would say it was the catalyst. I would say it started the tide turning for me. You know, where in future years at Sundance, I would see, you know, films like, Camp, or I can't think of others, but there's like 1.5 million of them that are great Sundance stories. Pariah, for example, there's no names in that movie, and when the more you see like that, the more that you reinforces that type of behavior, you know. So now when I look at a film festival booklet, I'll, you know, when I'm choosing my films, I'll pore over it very slowly and carefully, but the first place I look, because, and I'll say this, when I see, maybe part of the reason why I love seeing films at a film festival so much is that I love going in without knowing much of anything about them. So I try not to read too much about them in advance. That's hard when you're making a decision sight unseen. But so what I'll do is I'll start with the director, really. And if that's, you know, kind of compelling enough, I'll stop right there and won't read it about the film. But yeah, for sure, it started off the tide turning for me about, you know, caring at all about the star power behind a film. And it's actually kind of funny too, because now that I, you know, I started off knowing kind of nothing about Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and certainly, like, I would not call the writer, star, and director, John Cameron Mitchell, a household name by any means. You know, he's not followed by paparazzi, right? But interestingly enough, he actually, he lived in my neighborhood. I just moved to Brooklyn, but when I lived in Manhattan, he actually lived, must have been down the street from me or something like that. Because I would see him like once a week around town. And it turned into this thing where, like, every time I walk by him, I wouldn't stop him and say hi or something like that. But I had this, like, you know, I'm kind of starstruck just seeing him. So that's kind of a funny trajectory, I guess, for the film and the experience for me. I think he's amazing. You know, he went on to do Short Bus, which was pretty good, and Rabbit Hole, which was incredible, and I think my favorite film of that year. I don't know how involved he's going to be in the Broadway production of Hedwig, because all they've really announced about it, I think, is that Neil Patrick Harris is playing the lead, but I don't think John Cameron Mitchell is acting. I suspect he'll be just kind of around supervising how it goes and stuff, because that role was so important to his career. But yeah, he's totally a star in my mind now.
I'm sure there are many others like us who are always looking forward to what he's doing next, because I am a big fan of Rabbit Hole. I do need to get around to seeing Short Bus, though.
You know, I would call it lesser. I think it's still an accomplishment, and I own it. I wouldn't call it a departure for him in any way. I think it's a lot more. I'd say it's even more shocking than Hedwig from a sexuality perspective. And I think there's an integrity to it that you don't see a lot, even in independent film. But I don't know that it would win any awards anytime soon. Absolutely, you know, see it.
All right, well, thank you for talking to me, Dor.
Thanks for letting me blabber on about my favorite movie. I hope everybody...
I'm so happy that I can finally scratch Hedwig and the Angry Inch off this list, because this movie is something that I really wish more people saw.
Yeah, and I like the idea of a bit of a smaller title going on that list against some of the heavy hitters that you've talked about. I mean, totally well-deserved, you know, but... Heavy hitters. He was nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance. It won two awards at Sundance, including the Audience Award for Dramatic as well as the Directing Award. So it's worth your time.
Actually, I'm curious, thinking about this, like, this just popped up in my head. With smaller titles like this, Do you rather wishing that more people saw it, like, generally, or do you enjoy more the idea of always getting to introduce it to someone else?
That's such a good question. Both. I'd like to introduce it to everyone. Honestly, of course, there's like a secret fun in being like, this is my special thing and I'll share it with people who love it. But because it's got such talented people in it and such a powerful message, I think for the greater good, I would enjoy if more people saw it and it meant that people who made this movie were better funded and better, you know, and more supported, you know, in the press and all that good stuff for their future projects. So I would give up that, you know, the personal aspect of it if simply more people wouldn't get a chance to see it. I do think that Hedwig the Angry Inch has a very positive and powerful sort of legacy. I think people who love it really love it, and it's highly regarded, and it will be, kind of thought of as a, if not a bit trailblazing, absolutely one of the best in its genre for a long time to come.
So that's been the podcast. I'd like to thank you for listening. As always, you can hear the podcast through gmanreviews.com, through iTunes, through Stitcher. Go and give us a rating or review on iTunes, because, I mean, that is like the best way to support the show. To go and say, hey, I like this show. Or you could go and say, hey, I don't like this show. I mean, I really wouldn't like it if you did that, but I wouldn't ask you to not be honest. Also, leave a comment on the page over at G-Man Reviews, or just send a tweet to me and Dorothy in this episode. She's at Dor Dotson, I'm at G-Man Reviews. Just say hey, you never know. It could be the beginning of a big conversation. You could just tell us, hey, I love Hedwig, or oh my goodness, how dare you like Hedwig, and you never know where it'll go. But once again, thanks so much for listening, and good night.
Like your blood knows the way from your heart.